Okay, does anyone have any questions about the class so far? As you notice, attendance in the class has fallen off a little bit. It's not that enrollment has fallen off. This class is still full in the sense that every seat would be taken if everyone has signed up for the classes here. But that's to your advantage. By the way, Bruincast people, don't pay attention to this. I see most of you sitting in the front half of the room. It makes it into a much smaller and more intimate class, so that those of you who are here right now, you should feel much freer about raising your hand and asking questions if you kind of want to take issue with something I say or don't understand it or anything like that. I really want to encourage you to do that, because if the class is just me up here droning away and you sitting there and just taking notes and whatever I'm saying, you know, you just go to sleep. You just tune out. And the way to kind of get the juices flowing is to make it a more interactive class. And So, don't talk just for the sake of hearing your own voice, but if you have something real to say or something you don't understand, please feel very free about raising your hand, okay? So, today I'm going to be talking about the Paris Peace Conference of 1919, the conference in which the great peace settlement between Germany and the Western powers, the three Western powers, France, Great Britain, and the United States, the conference at which that peace treaty was hammered out. And you see, this is the first of two lectures on the peace conference and on the Treaty of Versailles. Why so much attention to this particular episode? Just the treaty, just the conference. Why two lectures, two whole lectures in this class are going to be devoted to this issue? Did you have your hand up? Oh, no, that's the way I teach with the rhetorical questions. Again, it's the same principle with people, you know, kind of falling asleep. So you want to always throw out questions so that people think, well, what is... You know, I've been teaching so many years. This. Of course, if you want to. That's it. Why is it? Because we're interested in something more than just the historical question for its own sake, the question of how the peace conference and the Treaty of Versailles should be interpreted. We're interested in examining the story closely for what it tells us about the really big issues that we're concerned with in this class. You know, the issues that define the whole field of international relations. The whole question of, you know, what makes for war, what makes for a stable international system, and, you know, using the sort of thinking that develops as people grapple with those issues, the question of policy. Are there any guidelines that we can identify that should shape the conduct of foreign policy in general, not just in this particular period, but in general? Are there any lessons to be drawn from the study of international politics in the past that are of value to us, continuing value to us, even today when the sort of world we're living in is very, very different, which can give us some insight into how policy should be conducted, right? So we're looking at the history for insight into those kind of basic issues. Yes? Why the war ended in the first place? Because Germany was constantly, throughout the war, reaching for a decision, a victory to defeat the Allies. Right? That That's the Schlieffen Plan. That's the decision to resume unlimited submarine warfare. They took that decision knowing that it would bring the Americans in, hoping that they would be able to knock the Western powers out of the war before America became an active belligerent, before American intervention could really swing the balance. Okay? And it didn't work. They tried very hard. Early 1918 also, spring of 1918, these German offensives based on the use of shock troops. Once they had shot their wad, done the best they could, they were totally exhausted. It was hopeless for them once these American troops started pouring in. And they thought that they can get a negotiated peace. Why? Because Wilson had laid out a certain program in his wartime addresses, most notably the 14 points, January of 1918. It seemed that Wilson was a great champion of the principle of self-determination. You could read certain things that Wilson said, if you read him selectively, as championing a moderate peace. And the Germans were under a certain amount of pressure from the Americans because Wilson had made it clear as in the summer and of 1918 that the sort of peace the Germans would get would probably depend a lot on whether the Kaiser remained in power, whether the imperial regime in Germany remains intact. And so in November 1918, the Germans had this revolution. They overthrow the imperial regime and they established what was to become the Weimar Republic, right? Without breaking the power of the old elites that had been associated with the empire and with William II. These people maintained their control of the administration, of the army, of the judiciary, and so on. But the Germans could say, well, we've turned over a new leaf. We're now a liberal democracy just like you, so you shouldn't have any punitive peace terms on us. All right? This you could argue, is a nice example of foreign-imposed regime change. The Americans put all kinds of pressure on Germany to get rid of the imperial regime and to institute a democratic republic. All right? And on that basis, the new German government negotiated an armistice with the Allies. Don't forget, Russia had been defeated. You had the Bolshevik Revolution, so-called October Revolution, which actually took place in November. I explained to you about the change in the calendar. The October Revolution overthrew the imperial regime in Russia. The Germans imposed this very harsh peace on Russia, the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk. They were victorious in the East. It was just a question of dealing with the Western democracies now. And they thought that they could reach a negotiated settlement that would basically allow them to come out of the war okay. And they had to do that because it was quite clear that they were in no position to withstand the Allied offensives. Don't forget, with the introduction of the tank and so on, we now have a resumption of the war of movement. Things are beginning to change quite rapidly on the battlefield. So the Germans reached an agreement with the West. It's called the Pre-Armistice Agreement. The First World War is not settled by the unconditional surrender of Germany. It's settled by a negotiated agreement to end the war, the Pre-Armistice Agreement. The Allies' hands are bound by the Pre-Armistice Agreement, right? Germany's not surrendering unconditionally. Part of the reason for the policy of unconditional surrender in the Second World War is people look back at what happened in the First World War and said it was a big mistake to settle the First World War by agreement rather than through the invasion of German territory and the occupation of Germany. But there was this agreement. What was the agreement? What did it call for? It said that the peace would be based on the principles that Woodrow Wilson had laid out in the 14 points and in his other wartime addresses, with two exceptions. two exceptions. One exception had to do with freedom of the seas. As you recall, this was the issue that the United States had supposedly gone to war over in the first place. But if you take the principle of freedom of the seas seriously, what's the use of naval power? And yet naval power is the primary instrument of British power. You know, enable them to conduct this blockade against Germany and so on. So the Allies said, no, we can't accept that. And Wilson didn't have any problem with jettisoning the principle of freedom of the seas, which is one of the 14 points. It's ironic, isn't it, given that this is supposedly what the United States entered the war over. The other exception had to do with the reparations. The war had been fought not on German territory at all. In the West, the war had been fought essentially in northern France. And the areas in which it had been fought, which were the most heavily industrialized part of the country, those areas had been devastated by the war, and to a certain extent even by deliberate German policy aimed at improving Germany's position for the post-war period, like the flooding of the French coal mines in northern France before the Germans withdrew. And so the second exception in the pre-armistice agreement was that there should be no doubt, they said, as to what the provisions calling for the restoration of the devastated areas in the 14 points and those other speeches meant with regard to what Germany would be liable for. Germany was to make reparation done for all the damages that had been caused by, they use the term German aggression, by land, sea, and air. Right, and on that basis, the Germans laid down their arms, and the Allies occupied the left bank of the Rhine. Right, this whole area here, plus a little strip on the right bank of the Rhine, actually three little bridgeheads on the right bank of the Rhine, making it impossible for the Germans to resume the war. So the war was ended before German territory had even been touched on the basis of this pre-armistice agreement. That's the end of the war. I mean, there's a lot more to be said, but just that's essentially what you need to know, because it's important for the later story. Because we'll see that the Allies essentially reneged on that promise, on the promise about limiting reparations to the damage done to the civilian population of the Allies. But that's, and the Germans felt a sense of grievance. We laid down our arms on the basis of a set of promises. We were promised the Wilsonian peace. We're not being given a Wilsonian peace. Therefore, we're morally justified in resisting this peace. Okay? It's based on, as we'll see, a selective interpretation of Wilsonianism. Anyway, let me rewind a little bit. So we're going to be studying all this stuff about the Paris Peace Conference in very great detail. Today, the kind of general issues. On Monday, the kind of the nuts and bolts questions, the specific issues. And we're doing it because of the light it will help throw on these basic questions of what makes for war. Is there anything you could say about how foreign policy should be conducted and so on? Now, why is this the case? And why is it important to proceed that way? The answer is that you can't get very far if you simply tackle these issues, these great issues, what makes for war, at a very high level of abstraction. You could only get at them if you study them in concrete historical context, concrete empirical context, because people come up with answers to those questions about how foreign policy should be conducted. And those answers, the kinds of answers they come up with, translate into or have a certain affinity with specific historical interpretations. You know, you say, well, the peace failed because Wilson's dream of a democratic order, an order based on principles of justice, Wilson was frustrated in this by the European allies. Very common view. Well, that's kind of supports the view that Wilsonianism is the way to go. If you, the way you should conduct policy is on the basis of these basic Wilsonian principles: self-determination, spreading democracy, you know, standing up for what's right, for what's just, for what's fair, you know, and so on and so on. On the other hand, there are people like George Kennan in the article that you read for this week who say, no, it's exactly the opposite. It's like, Wilsonianism is not the way to go. The kind of approach to policy that Wilson stood for was not the solution. It was a big part of the problem. So, well, who's right? How do you go about seeing who's right? By examining those arguments closely in terms of the historical evidence. And the answers that you get from doing that historical analysis will then tell you something about those big issues of, you know, how should foreign policy be conducted that way on the basis of moral principle. You understand, this is what's important here is that that's the common sense view. Before you begin to study these things, you know, you just take it for granted. How should foreign policy should be conducted? How should the United States conduct its foreign policy? Well, we should always try and do what's right. Our policy should be based on moral principles. You know, considerations of justice and fairness and self-determination and, you know, all these things that we associate with that liberal, you know, Wilsonian approach to policymaking, you know, people take it for granted. Of course that's the way to go. And that's why the approach of people like Kennan had so much power. It's counterintuitive. It runs against what the kind of approach to these things that people just absorb from the general culture take for granted. It's because Kennan is saying, no, you take that approach. Look at how it messes things up. You know, basically it leads you to say, we're not going to get involved in these mere political issues. You know, we'll only get involved when the moral issues are clear-cut. So before they're clear-cut, we wash our hands of all these things. But as soon as they are clear-cut, we become enraged. The war becomes a crusade. We are out to utterly destroy the adversary because it's a question of good versus evil. So that moralistic approach to policymaking, people like Kennan argue, leads to disaster. Right? Who's right? Who's right? How do you go about seeing who's right? Only one way, and that's by looking at the specific historical arguments that those general claims are connected with and examining those claims in terms both of their internal logic and in terms of the evidence. So that's what we're going to be doing today, focusing today and on Monday, focusing today on the general question of what sorts of basic policies are the three main powers that designed the Versailles Peace. What sorts of policies were they pursuing? Okay, we're trying to see whether the peace failed, as a lot of people think, because Wilson was defeated, because Wilson wasn't able to implement his peace program, because the Treaty of Versailles was in some sense, it ran counter to the Wilsonian program. And if that's the case, well then you can't blame Wilsonianism for what happened. You can't say that sort of policy leads to international instability. The policy was not that you had a Wilsonian peace, but that it was a non-Wilsonian peace. This is a very common argument that people make. If that argument is basically false, well, that has very important implications, I think. And you're going to see today that argument is false. That Wilson, contrary to what his defenders argue, was not the great champion of a peace of reconciliation with Germany. he was not the great champion of a moderate peace and so on, that he believed Germany had to be punished for what she did, and that that basic assumption lay at the heart of the sort of peace that was crafted in 1919. And you'll see also that that aspect of Wilsonian policy, the punitive aspect of Wilsonian policy, was not just some sort of accident that came into being because of the wartime hysteria or the sorts of, you know, angry emotions that take shape during a war. It was deeply rooted in the basis of his thinking and of liberal thinking in general. This is why we're going to be also looking at the British. And we're going to look also at the French, because the French did not take the Wilsonian view. The French had a very different approach to peacemaking. We're going to try and see whether the final treaty was in line with their view, as a lot of people say, or whether whether it amounted to the triumph of the Wilsonian approach. Right? So these are big issues that we're concerned with here. It's like this issue of what kind of policy should be conducted. You look at the Versailles Peace of 1919. It was not a successful peace. You know, barely a decade after it was signed, say in 1929 or so, it was clear that the Versailles system had collapsed. This is well before Hitler came to power in Germany, well before the Depression even, or a little before the Depression. And of course, 20 years later, you know, this new and, in fact, more dangerous war with Germany breaks out. An extraordinary fact, right? Because especially when you compare it with the sorts of arrangements that took shape after 1945 or at the Congress of Vienna, 1814, 1815, or even system that prevailed in the late 19th century. This Versailles peace, this peace of 1919, was the most unstable peace in the modern history of great power politics. And yet it was the only major peace settlement to be essentially dictated, imposed, by the three great Western democracies and by them alone. Is there a connection between those two facts? You know, important issue. Because it speaks to the whole question of, the democratic order conduces to international stability and so on. A lot of people in our own culture really want to believe this stuff. Right? And then, or you could kind of look at not just the Wilson policy, but the policy of other Wilsonian types, Jimmy Carter, President of the United States from 1977 to 1981, very Wilsonian, viewed as this huge failure. We went from the detente of the Kissinger, Nixon, Ford period to the war scare of like 1979, 1980. You look at the Gladstone. Gladstone is this very famous liberal prime minister of Britain in the late 19th century. He came into office in 1880 on what was a Wilsonian program. Gladstone was Wilson's great hero, as a matter of fact. And after a few years of trying to pursue a policy based on that sort of program, you know, Britain was in very bad shape. Britain had managed to alienate all the other major powers in Europe. Britain was on the verge of very bad relations, both with France and with Germany and with Austria, and even with Russia. Over and over again, or for that matter, George W. Bush, people say, well, this is Wilsonianism with machine guns. It's like, is there anything to be inferred from the record of that sort of policy that's of interest? Well, we're trying to get at those issues by examining these questions closely, trying to understand the connection there was between the sort of thinking that lay at the heart of the policy that Wilson and these other leaders pursued in 1919, and what happened subsequently. Okay? The essence of the Versailles Peace, the essence of the peace treaty that was imposed on Germany in 1919, the Treaty of Versailles, worked out at the Paris Peace Conference, was that Germany was not to have the same political rights as the victor powers. Germany was to be kept down. Germany was to be subjected to certain external controls on her power. She was not allowed to build up her power to whatever level she felt was appropriate. Germany was disarmed. Part of German territory in the west, the Rhineland there, was to be demilitarized. Germany was not permitted to fortify that area. Therefore, Germany was to remain vulnerable to Allied military pressure. In fact, the Allies had the right to occupy at least part of that area for up to 15 years. These were limitations on German power. Was this unequal treatment of Germany in line with the basic Wilson concept? The answer there is yes, it certainly was. When you say that the peace should be based on moral principles, on principles of justice, basic Wilsonian idea, what did that mean? Before the United States entered the war, Wilson had been the champion of a peace of reconciliation. Standing outside the conflict and viewing it from a more impartial stance, Wilson had called in January 1917 for peace without victory, peace among equals, a negotiated peace. Right? That was before the Americans entered the war, a little bit more than 2 months before the Americans entered the war. As soon as the United States enters the war, the whole Wilsonian approach shifts. You saw it in those wartime addresses. Given that we had been forced to enter the war, it must be because the other side was a criminal power. It must be because the other side is the embodiment of evil, because we never use force except when it's a question of right and wrong. And since we're right, they must be wrong. We're good, they must be evil. And if they're evil, you got to crush them. You can't compromise with evil. No longer any talk with a compromise peace. You saw what he was saying about people who called for a compromise peace, for a negotiated peace. These are defeatists. Their policies are not in keeping with fundamental American values. Germany has to be crushed, right? Because a war is a crime. And the policy he pursued at the peace conference was in line with that basic conception. The Germans had committed a crime. If you believe in justice, they have to be punished for that crime. If you believe in the rule of law, doesn't that mean that the criminal nation should be punished? These basic notions about the role that moral consideration should play in the shaping of policy lay at the heart of the Wilsonian conception of peacemaking. He took it for granted the Germans had caused the war. And just as an aside, Wilson, you realize, is the only American president to hold a PhD. And in fact, his PhD was in political science. Yeah? No. The focus was on Germany. Wilson had a certain sympathy for Austria. In the 14 points, he didn't call for that sort of settlement where the Austrian Empire was torn apart, and you had all these independent states created on the ruins of Austria-Hungary. Wilson called only for autonomy, for those areas within Austria-Hungary. Germany is the focus. Germany is the mastermind. Germany is the real evil power. It wasn't soft to Austria. Yeah. I don't think it was a question of Germany being successful, because the Germans were less successful in 1918 than they had been in 1916, right? 1916, it's still peace without victory. It's only after we come into the war that view really takes hold. So you have to think that our coming into the war is what triggers a set of psychological dynamics that leads people to say Germany is the embodiment of evil. But it's built on a fundamental moralistic approach to policy making, right? Yeah. The answer to that question is essentially no. I mean, this is one of the striking things about this whole approach to peacemaking. It's focused on the past, the crimes that they had committed. We got to punish these people. It doesn't look to the future. You know, how to create a stable international order, you know, based on an equilibrium of power and so on. And so far as Wilson is concerned with the future, it's all, oh, it's the League of Nations. The League of Nations will take care of everything. We don't have to worry about this stuff because we'll have the League of Nations to do it. It's kind of like passing the buck a little bit, you know, because they don't consider, well, how can the League of Nations really work? You know, and when the French basically say, well, if you want the League of Nations to work, it really needs an international army, Wilson says, we're not going to do that. That would be substituting international militarism for national militarism. And since militarism is an evil, we can't think in terms of power. Because you know, thinking in terms of power leads to all these awful things, militarism, the arms race, blah, blah, blah. You know, we have to get away from that. And so you know how he squares the circle there? It's basically, he simply assumes that the Germans are going to see things the same way he does, right? Since his view of what's just is not viewed as a peculiarly American view, Wilson is a universalist. He thinks he has a direct pipeline into the moral absolutes. And so, of course, any honest person anywhere in the world, even in Germany, is going to recognize what a terrible crime the war was, and the Germans are going to buckle down and make amends for their crime and do penance. He talks, you know, for like a 20-year period. So, and then when they really show that they're turning over a new leaf and have become nice, sweet, liberal democracy like us, then... Then we'll reintegrate them as an equal in the international order. But we have a right, and this is Wilson's own phrase, to subject them to what he called a generation of thoughtfulness. Keep them down from that period. But if they don't do that, then and they resist the treaty, and there's a question of what are you going to do to enforce it? Oh, we can't use force. I mean, it's like, what could be more of a recipe for instability? I'm just like, you think that a child could see this stuff? But no. So you have this whole notion that peace has to be based on moral principles. It has to take into account Germany's responsibility for the war. But Wilson simply assumes the Germans are responsible for the war. This is before the documents are out, before historians have had a chance to really study this stuff on the basis of the evidence. This, and as I say, this is a guy who's a political scientist, right? Professional political scientist. He'd been a professor and so on. It's strange. Now, you might say, what's the evidence for all of this? You know, it's... This is what I did my dissertation on, and it's as fresh now in my mind as it was when I worked on this in the late 1960s, because I was just astonished. Because I had, you know, basically bought into this approach that Wilson wanted, a peace of reconciliation, and he's a president that we really should admire, and so on. He stood up for moral principle, and the reason Versailles had failed was that Wilson was defeated by these kind of clever Europeans who thought in non-Wilsonian terms, and so on. And then, but when you start looking at the evidence, both what he said in public and what he was saying in private, you're just astonished by the degree to which he explicitly endorsed the notion that it should be a punitive peace. That the peace was explicitly based on this notion that Germany was mainly responsible for the war, and therefore Germany should pay a price for that. All right. And here's some of the evidence. This is toward the end of the peace conference in mid-1919, spring of 1919. The British Prime Minister, Lloyd George, tries to modify the treaty. And Wilson refuses. Wilson says he was not willing to change anything in the treaty because it was severe. That he wanted this to be a historic lesson so that people might know that they could not do anything of the sort the Germans attempted without suffering the severest kind of punishment. All right? He writes to another statesman at the peace conference, again in the spring of 1919. The treaty, he writes him, this guy was calling for a dramatic softening of the peace terms, saying that this harsh peace is going to lead to instability. And Wilson refuses. He says, "The treaty is undoubtedly very severe indeed. I have, of course, had an opportunity to go over each part of it as it was adopted. And I must say that though in many respects harsh, I do not think that it is on the whole unjust in the circumstances, much as I should have liked to have certain features altered." Let me get the thing down slightly. Okay. "I feel the terrible responsibility of the whole business, but inevitably my thought goes back to the very great offense against civilization which the German state committed, and the necessity for making it evident once and for all that such things can lead only to the most severe punishment." Right? It's like, this is not the Wilson that you were taught in high school, right? But it emerges very clearly when you look at the evidence with an unbiased mind. And then in public, after the treaty is signed, Wilson comes back, and there's a lot of opposition to the treaty, mainly focusing on the League of Nations, which was this integral part of the treaty. Right? Wilson's plan for collective security. And so it goes on this big tour of the country to try and drum up support for the treaty. And this is the argument he makes, not that America stands for reconciliation. We need to establish, a stable international order based on reaching an arrangement with the Germans that they can accept. None of that stuff at all. This is what he says. This 4th of September 1919. The treaty, he says, seeks to punish one of the greatest wrongs ever done in history. The wrong which Germany sought to do to the world and to civilization. And there ought to be no weak purpose with regard to the punishment. She attempted an intolerable thing, and she must be made to pay for the attempt. Again, 2 weeks later. "I hear that this treaty is very hard on Germany. When an individual has committed a criminal act, the punishment is hard, but the punishment is not unjust. The nation, Germany, permitted itself through unscrupulous governors to commit a criminal act against mankind, and it is to undergo the punishment." Right? That's a punitive philosophy. Not reconciliation with Germany, but these are criminal people. Not just the German government, population being too cowed to resist. It's like he holds the German people responsible. Doesn't matter that they changed their regime. Doesn't matter that they're now a liberal democracy. They're a criminal nation. They had committed this crime. We're going to have to keep them down. That's why the treaty was legit. Right? This is, I mean, I don't know if you, if this stuff strikes you as very surprising, because it's not the standard way in which Wilson is taught. But if you go back in the evidence, you can't help but see this. It's all over the place. But people kind of screen it out of their consciousness because they're not interested in an honest understanding of history. They're creating a mythology that can be used for, you know, our current political purposes. It's a basic problem to bear in mind. Well, what about the others at Paris? The British. British Prime Minister, David Lloyd George. He was a liberal, not just a liberal, but he was the leader of the left of the Liberal Party before the war. And he also, like Wilson, takes a very moralistic line. Again, calling for a punitive peace. This is March 1917, the Imperial War Cabinet. This is all secret at the time. Lloyd George argues that Germany should be punished after the war because, quote, the conviction must be planted in the minds of the civilized world that all wars of aggression are impossible enterprises. Men must in future be taught to shun war as every civilized being shuns a murder, not merely because it is wrong in itself, but because it leads to inevitable punishment. That is the only sure foundation for any league of peace, right? You understand? If you believe in the rule of law, you have to punish the lawbreakers. Right? These basic liberal notions, rule of law, points of justice, they imply in certain contexts a punitive approach to international politics. Again, a year later, August 1918, in the Imperial War Cabinet. Again, this is all secret stuff at the time. Germany had committed a great crime, and it was necessary to make it impossible that anyone should be tempted to repeat that offense. Then, with the end of the hostilities approaching, this is October 13, 1918. He suggests giving the German people a real taste of war and inflicting an even more humiliating defeat on them than the one that was then being negotiated. October 26 is just 2 weeks before the armistice. Lord George says that in the cabinet, that industrial France had been devastated and Germany had escaped. At the first moment when we were in a position to put the lash on Germany's back, she said, I give up. The question arose whether we ought not to continue lashing her as she had lashed France. Mr. Chamberlain is a conservative, not Neville Chamberlain, but his brother Austin. Mr. Chamberlain said that vengeance was too expensive these days. The Prime Minister said it was not vengeance, but justice. And he takes the same line in public. Right? There's a speech he gives at about that same time, 2 days before the armistice in London. We cannot forget the reckless wantonness with which the rulers of Germany, with the full assent of her people, committed this atrocious crime against humanity. They cheered their rulers for the deed. They would have cheered them today had they won. We must keep that in mind when we seek security. Justice, divine justice, the foundation of civilization. Justice must be satisfied. The country that recklessly plunged the world into that agony must expect a stern reckoning. As I say, it's important to bear in mind, Lloyd George is on the left. He embodies this liberal approach to peacemaking. People on the right tend to be more jaded. They don't think in those terms. They say, justice, not so easily defined. And when you look at internal British politics, like an issue of how to treat the Kaiser, the further you go to the left, the more violent the rhetoric is. The one member of the Labour Party in those days, furthest on the left, in the British cabinet, his name was Barnes. He was the one who called for hanging the Kaiser, not just for trying the Kaiser, but for hanging him. Okay. What about France? Everyone thinks, oh, France is the, you know, really vindictive one. France is the one who wants the harshest peace. France wants to crush Germany and so on. Man shaping French policy during this period is Georges Clemenceau, Prime Minister, He became prime minister in 1917. Also, in terms of internal French politics, a man of the left. But Clemenceau took the realist view. Let me pause a minute to explain why this is so. It's not because France is less democratic than the United States. In some regards, France was more democratic in those days. In large parts of America, major elements of the population, blacks in the South, were disenfranchised. You don't find anything like that in France. It's the geopolitical position of France is very different from that of America or even of England. They're there on the continent. They can't just pick up and move to South America. You know, it's like they have to worry about power realities. The Americans don't have to worry about that stuff. What do we have to worry about? Who's going to attack us? Canada? Mexico? You know, it's like huge oceans to the east and west. You know, who can attack a country like the United States that is so powerful in terms of its economic power? You know, like I told you last time, when you look at the figures for steel production, more steel is produced in the United States than by all five of the major European powers put together, and that they're going to kind of cross the seas and threaten us? No. So given how secure the United States was in that period, you could afford to think in these ideological terms. You can afford a moralistic policy. All right? Clemenceau understands that France is not in that position. France has to worry. What if you did treat Germany as an equal? Then German resources were such, German population was such, that Germany would be able to develop so much military power that she would overwhelm France if France was isolated. If America and Britain were not there side by side with France. And so you had to worry about power. But how? He was very skeptical of the Wilsonian approach. And he made all kinds of sarcastic remarks about Wilson. My favorite one is, he speaks like Jesus Christ, but he acts like Lloyd George. And there's just sneering both at Wilson and Lloyd George at the same time. But the basic Clemenceau idea is this whole notion that we had this kind of pipeline to the truth about what's right and wrong, that we could think in terms of moral absolutes. That's not the way things work. That's not the way, you know, the world is shaped. The world's not shaped by divine decree. It's shaped by centuries of struggle, by centuries of violence. Who's to say what's right and wrong in any absolute sense? You know? And what that means is that every people, every country has its own sense of what's right and wrong. We can't just expect that the Germans are going to agree with us when we say that they've caused the war and should be punished for it. And given that that's the case, we have to worry about the problem of enforcement. But how do the French deal with the problem of enforcement? By saying, we have to use force as soon as they get out of line, you know, attack them militarily, slam them down. That is not the French approach. Because coming from the great tradition of power politics and balance of power thinking, the French approach the problem in a more complex way. Because they're very, and their great hope is not to base their security on these Versailles constraints and keeping Germany down and artificially keeping German power limited. They want the maintenance of the wartime alliance with the Western democracies. They want both American and British troops to be there in northern France on a permanent basis. Because if you have the maintenance of that coalition of the three Western powers, it's going to outclass Germany, and you're not going to have to worry about Germany so much. Right? And so that's the fundamental goal of the French. The problem is, the Americans, and to a certain sense the British, they don't want to play that role. They want to pull back from involvement in the continent. And this is what creates this big problem for the French. You know, it leads them to think in terms of, well, they're giving us no choice but to support the system based on these artificial limitations on German power. we are, that's our one alternative we have. If we make it clear that this is our only alternative, maybe we'll get the British and the Americans to reconsider. But even more surprisingly than that, you find the French in the middle of the peace conference approaching the Germans and broaching the idea of a political accommodation between France and Germany, you know, saying that otherwise those two continental countries would be at the mercy of the Anglo-Saxons, and the only way to kind of get control of their own destiny is for them to reach an accommodation with each other. Right? That's a strand in French policy. It's not the only strand, but the French approach is radically different from the American approach. What can be said about these general issues. But general questions, general approaches only take you so far, and to see what policy really was, you have to look at what each country was doing on these nuts and bolts issues, territorial issues, non-territorial issues, and so that's what we're going to be focusing on next time. Okay, see you then.